Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chatting Between Takes. I'm so excited. It's Wednesday afternoon at 4, and I'm here with Hannah Anderson. How's it going, Hannah?
Hello, Sean. It's going good. I'm just sitting here in your house eating mini eggs, which you have delightfully placed in front of me, and drinking some Earl Grey tea and petting your cat. So there's a description of what's going on right now.
I love it. And by the way, for the regular listener, you know that we like giving these descriptions so that there's context and they can kind of come along for the ride with us. By the way, to the viewer, please go to Facebook or the listener and look at, you can see Hannah, aside from all her acting work, you can see her on the page. You're beautifully backlit right now. You got the incense going and you got two Sugar Skull little models behind you.
I didn't even notice that.
No, it's nice, right? I really appreciate you coming by today, by the way, because it's so nice to have guests. To the people listening, you know, you always get my voice or you get me in the car or whatever. And it can get pretty ranty, pretty whatever. So unless you want to rant, anything you want to rant about, Hannah? Anything stuck in your craw right now?
Man. You know, it's not often that I get a platform to just...
Anything you want.
Rant about anything that I want. You know what? Let's talk about, for just a second, ignorance and a lack of self-awareness.
Oh my God. What, have you been listening to the podcast? Let's talk about it. Well, maybe you want to name names, maybe you don't. Why is that hitting you hard right now?
Well, before we went live with this thing, we were talking about the whole being preoccupied with your cell phone.
Oh yeah.
And I can't tell you the amount of times I have been bumped into, walked into, knocked over from people who are spending, who are just looking down, looking up.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen a number of times people just literally walking into each other.
Yep.
Almost falling down, not even acknowledging each other, and they just keep going.
Well, and I think the lack of acknowledgement comes from the fact that we've sadly already crested over the wave to the point where, oh, you were on your phone, so it's fine. Because me too. Like,
because me too.
You know, like, it's okay because this is just what the world is right now.
Yeah, it's become socially acceptable. And it shouldn't be because, you know, if you're hanging out with your friends, I get that everyone has work to do, but we're so preoccupied with it. Like, if I'm with a friend and they ask me a question and I start talking and they're looking down at their phone.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, well, do you really want to know? Or are you just asking me a question for fun?
Oh yeah,
and that kind of thing, and that filters down into the whole, here I go, the whole TTC thing and whatever. You know, I have a friend who just once in a while shouts, "This is a society, people," because you need to be more aware.
More aware, and part of society, right? I mean, this is the one thing I notice when I'm on my phone is that I utterly am tuned out of whatever environment I'm in. So, you know, I go to the racetrack and all that. And when I'm out there, it's one of the times in my life where I'm on the phone the least. And I meet so many people. And it's sort of a conscious choice. It's like, you could look down at your phone at what? Instagram photos of Porsches? There's 100 here. But I feel like that's kind of a good metaphor for, like, not being a part of the very society. Like, we're looking at people and they're all around us.
Yes. And we're completely missing out.
Oh, yeah.
It's especially, I was just traveling in Europe in August, and I noticed everywhere I went, you know, I was in Scotland and Spain, Portugal and Paris, and most places I went, everyone's there with their selfie stick or looking on their phone. I'm like, God, you're in Spain, what are you doing? But one thing I noticed about Spain and Portugal, for example, is the people who live there, not the tourists, but the people who live there, they're interacting with each other, and it's very almost strange to see because you don't see it often here. Their family time is much more valued there. And they're out until all hours of the night talking and laughing and socializing with each other. And no one's on their phone.
So did you grow up with that? I mean, or is that something you didn't grow up with, so you yearn for it?
Well, I didn't have a phone until I was, I think, 16.
Right.
Or 17. I remember every year for Christmas, starting when I was like 12, I'm not even that old, but like one year I got a phone in my room and that was really exciting.
Oh yeah.
And then another year, yeah, I think I had my own.
And by the way, that has nothing to do with, like, I mean, yeah, post like 70s, but if you're a teenager with a phone in your room, even if it's corded, that's fucking heaven, man.
It's a big deal. And oh, it was corded. And we still, to this day, in my house in Winnipeg where I'm from, we have phones where you have to do the whole dial around.
I love it.
And friends would come over and not know how to use it.
Are your folks older?
They're in their late 60s.
Oh, okay. Because it seems one generation above that to still have the rotary phone.
They just really, it's kind of an antique house and they like having the phone. The only thing is, you know, you can't use it if you want to call Telus or something because they tell you to press one. And you're like, can't actually do that.
And so when you're going through these European countries and you see this way of interacting, because I mean, I have my own experience with this. Do you adopt that then? Like, do you come home and go, okay, I'm going to make that a part of my life now? Or, you know what I mean? Like, we're always trying to make, even our decor, you know, Hannah was complimenting our decor.
It's beautiful.
It's thank you. It's very inspired by where we, and even LA, we'll go to LA and we'll feel very free and like engaged at Venice Beach or whatever. And we'll come home and we'll call it LA and Toronto. How do we keep the travel vibe so that we don't just get sedate again?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that's one of the best things about traveling is that you learn so much about yourself and how you want to live your life. And yeah, you're constantly trying to bring that back and adopt it. And usually, I mean, when I first got back from Spain, it was sort of right back into the mess of things and I lost that pretty quickly.
Right.
But I'm thinking about doing like a no social media, turn off my phone one day a week kind of thing just to...
I try and do it all the time with Facebook, and everybody who's listening knows this. It's actually partly because of this podcast that I even didn't take Facebook off, because it's kind of how most people know when I'm posting a new podcast, unless they're already subscribing. And I do want people to know that. It's not really business. It's like a really advanced version of narcissism. Instead of just posting
a
selfie,
it's
a fucking hour of me talking about bullshit. Or getting you over and ensnaring, you know. Phenomenal. By the way, if you don't know, Hannah Anderson is a phenomenal actress. And are you calling yourself a writer-producer now? I mean, do you...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
a
you are.
A writer-producer-director.
Great.
I mean, it's, you know, it's my first project and I haven't... It's not finished yet, but I'm working on getting other things going. So I think it's just going to keep happening. I'm going to keep writing and producing and directing.
Amazing. So just so you guys know what we're talking about, it's a film called Comeback. It's called Comeback. And actually, Emily plays a role pretty close to Hannah in it. And it's a beautiful piece from what I've seen and what I've read. Tell us about it. Tell us how it came about. And what was it like moving into that writing, producing, directing aspect?
So the way it came about was quite sad, actually. About a year ago in September, my good friend Kent Nolan, who was also an amazing artist himself, passed away very suddenly. And I was blown away, and I wasn't sure how to deal with it, so I just started writing. I talked to a lot of people, actually, who said that they just started writing, and that was a good way for them to deal with it. I guess it's the creator in us. So I wrote a script in October, and I put it away in a drawer.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you not? Did you think it was too personal?
Yeah.
I
thought it was too personal. I didn't think it was maybe necessarily appropriate to share it, because people are uncomfortable with grief, and that's actually one of the main themes in the piece. So I put it away, and then I was talking to a friend of mine. I think it was Brett Donahue. I ran into him at the Gary Goddard Christmas
Amazing.
Party, your agency.
And by the way, to the listeners, Brett was our lead male in Barn Wedding. He's phenomenal, great guy, and brilliant actor. Yeah,
lovely. Also from Winnipeg. So he was very encouraging, and we talked about making something together. So he encouraged me to put it out there, and then I just started sending it out, and that was the scariest part. I think. I'd written a lot, but never shared it before. So I sent it out to some writer friends and got some great responses and some really helpful feedback. And I went to work on drafting and redrafting until I got something I was happier with, and then started putting a team together. So I got Scott McClellan, who's an amazing DP, and I had seen Emily Coates and Brett Donahue in your film, Barn Wedding.
Yeah.
And I knew both of them separately.
I need a bell for when anyone says Barn Wedding in
Barn
here.
Wedding.
Like, ding, da, dang, dang, dang.
You should have some theme music.
Yeah.
So I saw in that film, I thought that was very exciting, and I thought they had a really awesome chemistry. And I'd seen Emily Coates and her work and thought she was incredible and has an amazing emotional depth to her and also has some experience with grief. So I thought she'd be perfect. and asked her to do it, and she said yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually, I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, casting people opposite my girlfriend for chemistry. But when Brett walked in, I mean, the chemistry they had was just, and I always say, it wasn't what Brett did, and it wasn't really an audition, but we were keeping a lot of people in mind. It was what he did to her.
Oh.
Because she's, you know, it's...
How he affected her?
Well, you know, you've done some of the Meister stuff with me. Like, it's... We have to leave ourselves alone, and it's what's happening to the other person. Mm-hmm. And Brett tapped right into that. But it's also, okay, Emily was acting with maybe the other people, but she was just being affected by Brett. You know, he has that quality. So I can't wait to see your film and see how that comes across in a different context, one that I'm watching as a viewer, not as a director.
It's pretty amazing, actually, with people and actors. You either have a chemistry or a connection with someone, or you don't, and I don't know how to explain that.
And it doesn't even have to be good.
You know, but there, there can be
tension or a crappy feeling,
something lying underneath. And I felt that too when I took some Meisner classes with Sean back in the spring, and there were a couple people in the class who I just really connected with, and there was just something.
Well, this
something
is how stuff
there.
Gets created, you know. And even when I was hosting the open mic, it's not unlike the Meisner class, where as much as I'm sort of like, you know, chipping in even with guitar at the open mic to create something, i.e. running it, it's the facilitating that's almost better. And like, there's a band called Crooked House Road with Shayna.
She met
Miriam there totally through that thing. And then they formed a band. And, you know, Kelly and Emily had met, and that's how we formed Barn Wedding. And then her and Melanie met in Meisner, and that's how they're starting to work on something, Melanie Leishman. So like, it's as exciting for me, and it's weird because I realize I'm maturing, that's as exciting for me to see chemistry between other people than being the one in the chemistry, because I know I have enough chemistry going around in my own way. But it's really cool. Did you find that? Did you find directing altered how you act?
Yes. Yes. It's, I directed this at the end of June and didn't start acting again until a couple weeks ago. But while I was behind the lens, it was a whole different perspective. It was so different having an outside perspective on the story and seeing, yes. And seeing, you know, when I was writing it, I had all these visions, these pictures in my head, and then it's coming to life right in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if I ever had to direct Emily or Brett, which was rare, it was never personal. It was, you know, it was just always about serving the story better. And I also realized, like, the actor is very important, but the actor is just another piece of the puzzle.
It's, see, this is the thing, if I can chip in.
Yes, please.
It's like if you're playing guitar at age 14, home alone in your room, you think you have to sound like Led Zeppelin. But you don't. You just have to sound like the guitar in Led Zeppelin. Or the piccolo in the orchestra. But because we're running these lines alone in our head and we're picturing what the show will be like, I just do too much. I'm just the piccolo or just the trombone, like, period. And that's one thing that I got from it was...
Yeah, that's right. You're an instrument in the band, or you're a... Mm-hmm. And it's the same feeling I get when I'm feeling like, oh, God, I've got so many problems in my life. I don't. But then, you know, I look up at the sky or I look up at the stars, and it sounds cliche, but I go, oh, fuck, like, I'm fine. I'm doing fine.
Yeah,
I mean, a little tiny little piece, and that makes me feel really good.
Well, I love that you're saying all this, because obviously it's all I kind of go on about on this thing is like, how to get out of our own way. And, you know, you talked about that with your initial little rant, which was, you know, by the way, if you're listening, that was not prompted. But the idea of having a lack of self-awareness, because there's the physical lack of self-awareness. But for me, it's this idea that... my problem's so big that I'm going to be shitty to another person, or I'm going to be crabby to the person at Tim Hortons. And it's like, that's a lack of self-awareness too. Like, that's sort of an arrogant rudeness based on an inflated sense of self-importance. And that's one of the ones that gets to me, is it's like, what are you so fucking on about right now? Like, look up or get off the phone or whatever. And by the way, feel the pain you're actually feeling, instead of projecting it onto, oh, traffic's what's bothering me. Yeah, I don't want to be late, but I just have pain in my body.
There you go.
So let's talk about that for a sec. Was there a hesitance? You know, I didn't know Kent well, but I know Kent. Everybody in town does. Was there a hesitance because there could be a sense that you're trying to claim ownership over that grief more than others?
Over that story? Yes. And that was one of the main reasons I put it away in a drawer at the beginning. Right. Because, you know, I'm doing this for Kent and memory of Kent. Because we had talked about working together, doing mm-hmm. a project together, and that just never happened. So, yeah, that's something that I'm concerned about. But I think people who know me know that's not the intention behind the right. project. So, yeah.
Yeah. I've never got that. You know, I talk about this. My parents are still alive. My friends are still, like, I've never got that call, that surprise call, you know. And as we talked about Emily, and she's talked about it, I think, even on the podcast, but, like, you know, the way things went for her and her dad were a little slower, but very abrupt. But this was abrupt. This was, you're going to meet someone out one night, and then you get a call that you're never seeing them again.
This was abrupt, and it was, I'll never forget. I mean, you never forget these phone calls. And I've lost people in my life, but never someone so close my own age. So the way I found out was I was filming, actually, out in the forest on the set of a sci-fi show, Killjoys. And someone came up to me and said, your agent is trying to get a hold of you. It's urgent. And that never happens.
Right. Especially when you're on set.
Yes.
You're already taken care of. You're good.
I thought, oh, maybe I've got an offer in or something exciting is happening. So I rushed back at lunch to my trailer and called Emma. And she said, I had some news for you. And I went, uh-huh.
Oh, God.
And then it was the complete opposite. And I just lost my mind. And yeah, I just spent the hour at lunch in my trailer just sort of crying and having a really tough time. And then I had to go back out and pretend like nothing had happened.
And you do have to.
And
go
I
out.
Went and filmed my own death scene, which was...
Are you fucking kidding
I
me?
Am not kidding. It was very surreal. It was very bizarre. They ended up cutting this scene, but I'm crawling through the mud in the woods, and I've got this CO2 gas around me. I can't really breathe.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Didn't Killjoy, actually happen.
Spoiler
Thanks
alert.
A lot, Killjoys. And I'm shooting with a machine gun with one hand, and my face is melting off. And then I had to. At the last shot was giving this blood-curdling scream as I'm dying, and that was... There was something very cathartic about that, but also very strange, and it put everything into perspective. It was sort of like everything slowed down. I was looking around me going like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, this doesn't even matter.
It doesn't matter. And by the way, apparently Killjoys is a great show, but that to me is an example of something that really doesn't matter. Like, yeah. I'm not saying that like Sci-Fi Channel stuff, but I don't know. Like, it could be argued that certain shows move the needle. That's just great entertainment. And at that point, especially, I can imagine, because while not with regards to death, but with regards to deeply important things to me, having to go to set sometimes, you're just like I was shooting Covert Affairs, and they had like two top floors of a hotel booked out. I mean, this must have been $100,000 a day just for location. It was season 5. They kept talking about how much money they had to blow up things on Yonge Street. And I remember just thinking, is this show that good? Now, granted, it's all coming from advertising revenue, so it's not like... You know, I'm not of that mind like that had to go to a homeless person. Right. You know, I'm sure there's some tax benefit or something, but that's just the role of business. But I was just like, wow, like fucking mobilized resources for this. And on that day, I was going through something myself and I was like, really? Like, really? And then on another day, you're like, oh my God, we get to blow up something on Yonge Street.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. It's just, I mean, it depends on your mood and your perspective on that day. But sometimes I think, yeah, is what I'm doing really important?
Okay, let me jump in then, because you just said something about mood and perspective. And Emily Coates, okay, so to the listeners, Emily Coates is one of the most brilliant actresses on the planet. She's also a producer and writer herself, and might live with me in unwedded bliss. So she had a question for you, Hannah. Hannah, talk about the struggles with understanding the difference between unemployed and unemployable. How do you stay sane between jobs and not convince yourself that you're the issue? And then she said, word it better. And I don't think that needs to be worded better. I think she's worded that pretty well.
No, Emily, I understand exactly what you're asking. This is something I talk to with actor friends of mine all the time.
It's the conversation.
And it is the conversation. It's one of the most difficult parts about the business because you are your instrument, as you are. And it's very difficult not to take things personally. And you mm-hmm. go out for hundreds of auditions and you literally get rejected hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times.
That is very difficult. But I think, you know, I think the key is not basing your self-worth on the work that you get, which is definitely the hardest part. So
what do you place your self-worth in then?
Living. Really?
Go,
I mean,
go. What? I mean, living. What? You know, I love
like,
this. I need
like,
this.
Like this summer, I was like, fuck it. I'm going to go to Europe. Didn't really have the money. I just went up. I went up and left, and it was good for my soul. It's what I needed. It was a good distraction. And while I was there, I booked something. And I think that was hopefully the universe going, yeah, you're on the right track. Just go live. And, you know, this happens to me every time I book a plane ticket somewhere. Like in January, I was going to Mexico, and I got a call saying there's always some sort of important callback or producer session the day that I'm flying.
Yeah,
and they wanted me to rebook.
Then
I was like, no, I'm going to Mexico. And I lost out on that opportunity. And that's okay because I had an amazing time in Mexico.
Well, even me going to Germany, really I good. Have to say I'm not auditioning basically this week. Mm-hmm. For anything that's going to go next week. And then next week, I'm going to miss anything. And that's life, you know?
That is life. And it's also the whole FOMO thing, the fear of missing out, you know? Because you're like, I'm going to go away and there's going to be some amazing project I'm going to miss out on. But no, I mean, it's just what you choose to put your focus in.
Well, and you said something interesting too, you know, which is just the idea. Okay, I'm going to try and remember this so I can phrase it well.
Okay.
It's living. Oh, yeah. No, it's about the idea that the universe is going, you're on the right track. And I would even contend for myself as much that it's not even that the universe is saying that was the right choice. It for me, it points even more to the randomness of it or that how ineffective it is to stare at the phone. Mm. And I don't mean the Instagram social stuff. I mean waiting for it to ring.
It's the watch pot never boils.
Right. So it'll boil when it boils. Uh-huh. I'll put out what I put out, but I shouldn't not take the trip to somehow guard or be hyper-vigilant for something that needs no vigilance.
Maybe that's a better way of putting it, because you're right, it is extremely random.
That's the only thing for me, and that, you know, I rankle personally, and not for you, I rankle at the universe idea, because I always believed I was the center of the universe, and it was kind of the root of most of all my problems. And so I had to go, what if it's just what it is, and I have to figure out how to be okay with it.
That's a bit more comforting, isn't it? Because you don't, there's something, I'm going to try and make this a metaphor. It's like when I'm getting into a plane, I used to be terrified of flying. Mm-hmm. But now I really fucking enjoy it. I'm saying fucking a lot, sorry.
Yeah, oh,
but I sit,
welcome
you know,
to
I
chatting between takes.
I sit in the plane and I give up all control.
Exactly.
And I love it because you know, it's just too much. You can't control everything. You can't sit by the phone and wait. And why not just go off and live your life? And like acting is just a secondary part of your life. It's living first and then acting second.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I think that's what Emily's getting at. And I think that's what I, you know, have trouble with still, you know, being a little further down the road than you on the path of at least time in. And it's just, yeah, like, that when we're sitting here and we're talking and, you know, because again, this is community, this is friendship, and we're even creating work through this. I mean, this is, the podcast is a version of expression. And so I feel very satisfied, you know, and I'm going to go do karate tonight and I golf this morning. So there's a satisfaction to it all. But tomorrow at 2 p.m., when I'm hollow and alone for that moment, then the voices start going, you need to fire your agent. So-and-so does more work than you. You know, and it's like, what? Where are you coming from?
Yes. And I think a lot of those voices do come from social media, bringing it back to that whole thing. Mm-hmm. When you're out living your life, you know, if you find those things that make you happy, like for me, it is a form of creating. I love spending time in the kitchen, cooking dinner with a glass of wine, baking and listening to the radio or playing music really loud and singing at the top of my lungs. Or sometimes if I'm having a down day, I'll put on some T-Swift. Mm-hmm. Have myself a little dance mm-hmm. party. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Shake it off. You know what
Haters
I mean?
Haters gonna hate. Yeah.
I love T-Swift.
To the boy over there. Oh, I love this album, Non-Irona. Yeah.
So you
have
just...
you heard the Ryan Adams
version? No.
Ryan Adams recorded the whole album start to finish.
Stop.
And to the listener, that's not Bryan Adams. Although Ryan Adams will often do Run to You in concert because of how often he gets confused with Bryan Adams.
Oh, I love the sense of humor.
So I didn't like Shake It Off by Ryan Adams. I thought it was a bit hokey.
Okay.
Because, you know, hearing someone be pretty moody and going, shake, 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 shake
I'm
it off.
I was
like, it felt very tepid and like overdone to me. So I was like, yeah, I mean, I don't think the Ryan Adams thing, I think it's like hipster bullshit. And then I just pulled up Blank Spaces or Blank Space, whatever it is. And it's brilliant. Like fucking brilliant. We'll play it after. I think there's like copyright. I can't play it on here. But it's brilliant. And I went, oh shit. And then I went, holy shit. We all know this from day one, but this is why Taylor Swift is such a good songwriter. Because you hear that song and the chord changes and the lyrics. You know, and All Right Your Name is a pop hook, but when you hear it sung the way he does it, I'll play it for you. You're going to love it.
I'm excited. I'm excited.
So I have a question for you. You just did a movie with Katie Boland.
Yes.
Okay, Katie and I have been playing like a Facebook message tag because we keep planning to do this.
She's so busy.
She's so busy, and we've been having a blast trying to do it, but... So she's online right now, and she had a question for you.
Hi, Katie Boland.
Wait, tell us what the movie you did first.
So it's called Love of My Life.
Ooh.
We Katie play sisters.
Okay, no,
is Katie the love of my soul? She is the love of my
LGBT
life.
LGBT drama.
I mean, that's our next movie.
Okay.
Katie, are you writing that yet?
I'll direct it.
I bet you will. she is fabulous. We had a lot of fun on that set. So it's kind of a complicated story. And it's basically like a dramedy sort of comedy kind of thing about family and the complications that come along with that.
Amazing.
Funny, because we were just talking about family before we started this.
Oh, yeah. It's complicated. I mean, for those of you who are new today and haven't been listening to the last year, I'm going to Germany with my mom next week for a driving tour. And she kind of loves and hates Germany. And I've been there since 1983, I think, or 82. So it's going to be intense. And I think a lot of fun. Katie Boland's question for you is this.
Oh.
She said, dot, dot, dot. She has such a stillness when she works, she being you. How does she achieve that? She being you. Hannah Anderson, how do you achieve your stillness when you work?
Stillness. Wow. See, that's amazing. That's the last thing that I think I am.
Blind spots.
Because in my head, I'm going... I mean, I might outwardly appear that I'm very relaxed. And I am a good amount of the time. But when I'm on set and they're about to say action, I'm like my heart's beating and I'm thinking in my head about all the things, all the beats I have to hit and all these things. And then when they say action, something sort of shifts and then it's more about living in the moment. And I mean, I felt very comfortable acting with Katie and we had a great chemistry and great rapport. So I think I just felt more comfortable.
Hold on. Give me one sec.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I actually just had to send a work text there. Say that last bit again. I know everybody else heard it, but I missed it. Sorry, it's the middle of the day, people. I have to listen. With Katie, that you have a rapport and you felt comfortable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were playing sisters, and I've known her peripherally for a while. And I just felt comfortable. Like, I felt like I was in good hands. I mean, really, when you're in a scene with someone, it's all about your scene partner. And she's a pro. I mean,
oh, yeah.
She knows what's going on. So I just, I felt like I was in good hands and like let go. Yeah.
So let me ask this, you know, this is called Chatting Between Takes for a reason. You know, fundamentally, the idea for me is that great coffee table chat you get into with people that goes, you know, pretty deep, pretty quick. Mm-hmm. Although one thing that doesn't get talked about much on sets, not never, is actually your approach to the work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it almost seems like, I don't know. I feel like there's a little bit of like, you don't get into how you're going to approach the scene. I don't mean the story points, but in any case, maybe your experience has been different. If you get a script, how are you approaching it? And then on the day, how are you approaching it?
Those are good questions. It's definitely evolved. Right after theater school, I graduated from theater school like 3 years ago. I was very by the book and very like, I'll get my lines. You know, George Brown.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, George Brown.
George Brown dropout.
George Brown.
Hey, oh.
You rebel. So
George
get
Brown.
A script. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
I wish
I was a rebel.
I would get a script and break it down beat to beat and go, I think these are the actions that I'm playing and yeah. all that kind of bullshit, you know, which bullshit. Can be helpful if you're really stuck in a scene. And then I'd go in, I'd be very robotic.
Right.
Because I found it very overwhelming my first few times on set. Paint by numbers, you don't, that's not, I mean, that's not creation, you know, that's not living inside of a character. So now I look at it much differently. I read it through once, and then I let that be for a bit, and just sort of, usually, you know, I'll be sleeping or dreaming or in the middle of a random moment in a day, and something will come to me about the character, mm-hmm. or I'll see someone, I go, oh, that's it. So I usually try to think of someone that reminds me of this character, and try to assume that I am this character until, you know, like I try to relate it to myself and my experiences as much as possible, because we have so many different parts and sides of ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And then now I used to, again, memorize my lines like way in advance. Oh, yeah. And that's a downfall, because I had a director say to me once, I was playing like a drug addict prostitute typecast.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, that's great, but you know your lines too well.
Right.
And then I couldn't get it after that. So I learned my lesson. And since then, now I learn my lines maybe the night before, maybe the morning of.
Sure.
And that's a scary thing for me.
It is a scary thing. You're hanging it out.
You're letting it, but like that's, you know, when we're talking, we don't plan ahead what we're going to say. You no. just, it comes to you. So I'm trying to go more with the flow.
Amazing.
And just see what comes out, not plan ahead.
It seems to be working, because Hannah has just booked one of the more coveted roles in this city. Do you know there's buzz around you right now? Are you aware of this?
I don't know that there's buzz.
You have to know this, because you've just booked one of the lead roles in this new show called Shoot the Messenger. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So for me, the idea of buzz is simple. Everybody knows you've booked this part for two reasons. One is that everybody either auditioned for that show for that part, or there's only so many shows a year up here in our country, and this is one of them, you know. And so what is it, a 6-part miniseries?
Eight part, 1 hour. Just adjusting the mic here. La 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 la. We had a cat on the table earlier.
Yeah.
Madeline gets affectionate. What was the question? I forgot.
You're just talking about the show a little bit. You've got this 8-part show called Shoot the Messenger.
So 8-part show. It's they're calling it a recurring. I'm calling it a series regular.
Recurring bullshit.
I'm in every episode.
I saw that breakdown.
So it's very exciting. It's my first series regular.
Congratulations.
Quotations, role.
No, we're calling it that. We're putting it on the resume.
It's on the resume. It's online. Okay, go check it out. It's not on IMDb yet. But it's also a character that a type of character I haven't had the chance to play. Didn't think I would get that chance.
Yep.
Because I'm usually sort of, I always thought I would be the young ingenue, and I would have been fine with that. But it's actually been, I've had a lot more variety in my career than I expected. And lately it was like tough girl in the woods with some sort of bow and arrow or machine gun, who's like fighting for the cause and ends up dying in the end.
I get that. I mean, look, you're stunning, but you are very composed, and you have a grounded sense of self that's part of that, you know. Katniss Everdeen has to have a sense that she could blah blah blah, as opposed to it all being a shock that she can hit someone in the heart with an arrow, you know. It
right.
Well, I guess she never quite does that, but you know what I mean. Is
don't
that,
give it away.
Don't give it away. Does she? I'm not. I don't even think I'm caught up. But
neither am I.
Oh God.
I don't know.
Okay, so she mows everybody down in the heart with arrows. But in any case, I see why you might be booking those roles, because that would suit you.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful for that. I mean, it's been really interesting. I love shooting in the woods. I mean, it's a whole other acting partner, being outside in nature.
Oh, yeah.
It's the best.
The first series I did, you know, I'd come out of theater school, and I was feeling, and then I did a bunch of plays. So there's so much imagination almost needed to see the space, you know. And if you're looking out, there's that whole, I'd call it almost lame theater construct, where you're supposed to, like, make the audience feel like, you know, and hopefully that's changing. But in any case, I remember shooting my first outdoor scene as snowflakes were falling. And that thing was on my demo for 5 years, because it's one of the only bits of grounded work I did in my first 5 years. Because everything I was seeing was actually, you could see the air.
It's real.
You could see, I'm about to kiss this girl, and you can see the breath coming out of her mouth. Mm. And it's like, that's actual. So I learned through weather how to be in the moment, because I'd come out of all this, again, I don't say fuck you, George Brown, but I say fuck you to training that puts you so far in your head that you can't see the breath coming out of the girl you're about to kiss his mouth.
Yeah.
That's a lot more interesting to me than what my fucking beat is in that moment. And so that's why I obviously go away from that and toward what we do together.
I like that word, the whole grounded word. I mean, that's so true. When you're out and you're breathing that fresh air and everything around you is real. Those trees aren't made by some construction guy. Although I'm not knocking any of the studio stuff. That's incredible. But yeah, there is just something more grounded about that.
No, they're truly brilliant. And they're brilliant not in that, like, we all have to support our troops even if we don't agree with the war. Like, why? You know what I mean?
Why?
But the crew guys making, they're all basically brilliant. I mean, those shows, those sets, you don't know what's indoors or out.
They are.
You in a relationship? You want to talk about?
I am in a relationship. I'm basically an old married woman.
Okay.
So guys, sorry.
I never know when people are on here and they got the careers, how they want to go with this. Of course, I know you're in a relationship. And,
yeah, I mean, well, I'm very lucky to be in the relationship that I'm in. We've been together. His name is Matthew Edison.
Yeah. Who, by the way, I did the Soul Pepper Young Company training with about 15 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Me and him hit it off right away. He was going to do Laertes in the Romeo and Juliet. I dropped out of all that because I got my first TV show. But we hit it off right out of the gate. And I remember thinking, A, he's a fabulous guy. And B, he's a fabulous actor. And so, you know, it's great that you guys are connected.
He is.
That way.
And the way that we met is very funny. So I'm from Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know.
I don't think you've mentioned that.
You know this story. Oh, Winnipeg. I love Winnipeg.
Jesus. I don't think I've ever heard the word Winnipeg.
Can you just edit that out a little bit?
Have you heard our song, Winnipeg?
I hate. Oh, my God. I have.
Okay.
I have.
Maybe you could play that at your wedding or something.
Yeah, if I ever get married.
Oh,
that's a whole other topic.
Oh, my God. Wait, let's talk about this. Okay. So let's first hear how you guys met.
So I wasn't acting at the time. I was an extra. We've been together for 7 years. So 7 years ago, I was an extra on this comedy show in Winnipeg.
Called
House Party.
The fucking peg.
And Matt was playing a British man on the series. He was one of the main actors.
Okay.
So it was one of my first time being an extra. I was told not to talk to the actors.
Sure.
I was very excited to be on set.
Yeah.
So I thought Matt was very handsome from the beginning.
I think Matt's handsome.
He's very handsome. Yeah. Anyone could fall in love with him. And he had this British accent. And I was like, well, score. He's also British. Yep. But he wasn't. He's just really good at the accent. So I think actually our first meeting is captured on camera because he had to pick an extra to flirt with.
No, he didn't.
And he said, oh my God, that
was he
one.
Bruce Willis or something?
He said, that one. So I came over and... he remembers me being very awkward and shy because I was told not to talk to the actors. So right. I was saying as little as possible.
I love that he's using his power. I mean, this is sheer awesome, like, you know, I'm going to pick the chick, dude.
Yeah.
Come on over here, baby. So you can't talk to me, but I'm going to talk to you a little bit right now.
And that's, and I, you know, and I found him very charming and I was with someone at the time.
Ooh.
So drama. Ooh. And we were on that set. They used the same extras for about 6 weeks. So we got to know each other. And then he went back to Toronto and I thought I'd never see him again. Mm-hmm. And then he called out of the blue a few weeks later.
Oh my God, I love this.
And we just kept talking. And then eventually
this is a Hugh Grant
came
movie.
To Toronto.
Yeah.
To visit some friends.
Yes.
Quotation marks.
Quotation marks.
But really, I went to see him.
And did you have a plan? I mean, you had a plan to
I
see each other. You
I
didn't
mean,
have a plan
I mean,
to see
like,
each other.
I mean, like, we knew, I wanted to see him.
But you booked that flight on faith.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, I did.
Oh, we and love romance around here.
We ended up spending every day together.
And sorry, can I back up a little? What happened to the other dude?
I mean, I love the guy, and we were best friends, but, you know, we ended it, and... Uh-huh. Then Matt and I decided to... We both cried.
Yeah, you both
a lot. We both cried a lot. And we tried to be friends. And it was very difficult. That was my first breakup. And it was very hard.
Wow.
And then Matt and I did long distance for about a year. But 2 months into our relationship, I think, he came to Winnipeg to do a play. at MTC, and we lived together for like 2 months and fell madly in love.
Wow, this is great.
And then a year later, I was in journalism at the time, and then I said, I'm quitting. I'm moving to Toronto. I moved in with him. I got into George Brown, and we've been together ever since.
What was the journalism school?
It's called Red River College.
Fuck Red River College.
Fuck you, journalism.
So I got two questions for you about this, and they're relevant because, you know, you and Matt have an age difference, not dissimilar to me and Emily.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first one is, career-wise, as an actress, you're dating a more established actor.
Yeah.
You're dating someone who's in the flow, who's working. Was that ever a problem for you? Carving out your own identity in a town where while you're showing up, you're on the arm of someone else's career.
Yeah. I mean, it was inspiring. I mean, he is probably one of the main people who inspired me to pursue acting.
Right.
Because he was one of the first people I'd ever met. I saw like, oh, acting is a viable career.
Right.
And I'd never thought that before. So kudos to him on that. The difficult part was, yes, I was 19 when I moved here, and I didn't know anybody except for Matt, and I was very dependent on him. And we'd go out to events, and it was always like, I'm Hannah, I'm Matt's girlfriend, I'm Matt's girlfriend. And even up until, you know, a few years ago, and still now, I have to, like, if people don't know who I am, I go, I'm Madison's girlfriend.
Right.
And they go, oh.
Yeah.
Which is great, but I think now I'm starting to make a name for myself.
I'm in the exact same place with Emily. You know, this year at TIFF, I don't even know if she noticed it as much, but Emily was there on her own steam, whereas in the past, like, I'd get to a party and she'd be like, everyone's asking me where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, she has her own crew, her own flow. Some people are like, oh, is Sean coming? But it's not, you know, she'd be there anyways.
Yeah, but it's difference. A separate... Your own individual identity. And eventually,
not always easy for me. I liked having that, like, you know, it's like, where'd that, you know?
Where'd that go? Now it's like, I'm Sean, I'm Emily's boyfriend.
Right. Well, sometimes, and by the way, I didn't realize that I needed that until it started to go another way. And I think part of it for me is this inherent distrust that I have just inherent value. So the idea that me is enough is challenged when the me that could be her entree into a business is no longer needed. It's working, but fuck is it hard, because I didn't realize that I had that egoic connection with that sort of imbalance. And obviously, just like with Matt, like, I want her to be a way more fucking successful actor than me, especially because I've, you know, screwed the pooch for a while. And it's like, don't do that. Go, you know, but it's still hard because then I don't get to be the like wise old fucking mentor. Hopefully Matt's not that much of a dick.
No, he is the most.
Wait a minute.
He is the most supportive.
Means,
he is the most supportive. And we both go through those ebbs and flows in our career, but it's just nice to have, you know, some people say they would never date an actor.
I love it.
And I love it. It's just nice to have someone to shoot the shit with.
And she fucking, the other day, I won't share her story, but Em came home with a bunch of stuff from some acting work she'd done. And we just talked about it for so long, and she pulled out the written work she'd done, and it was just like, boom, it was like we're firing on all cylinders. It was great. What was that reaction to the wedding idea? If you ever get married.
Yeah, the wedding thing is like, you know, I always thought growing up, yeah, I want to get married and have a big wedding. And I think now I've met so many unhappily married people.
Right.
And the idea behind marriage is not the same anymore. It's more of like a showing off. Like, you're paying all this money, you're going through all this stress to have this event so other people can see your love. And it's really not about the partnership anymore.
Right.
You know, I think it's just lost its value.
Right. Well, that's an interesting one, because I didn't ever want to get married. And I've talked about this really openly in the podcast. And then I met Emily. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I just hadn't met the right person. And then I'm not saying that for you, obviously, this is my experience
with
personal.
It.
But yeah. And then even when she and I sort of, you know, daydream about it, you know, it'll be anything from eloping to the big wedding. And for me, the one thing I do like is the classical idea of the two families witnessing and bonding that thing. But I do get it's like, and even, you know, one of the podcast hosts I listen to, he goes, if you don't own your own home, don't spend more than $5,000 on your marriage. put that fucking money into a down payment and get a jump start on life.
There you go.
I actually love that idea, by the way. I mean, the one thing I talk about a lot is, so me and Em are down to like pennies when it comes to paying bills. I'll be like, you owe me $43.22 for cable. The reason is so that I can then just come home and have bought her a bunch of shit romantically. But if she owes me fucking $42.22 for cable, but I won't ask her for it, and therefore I'll resent her.
Yeah.
And in that resentment, I won't then want to buy her dinner. And vice versa. But so I'm saying that because I believe that fiscal responsibility can actually pave the way for romance.
Well, it takes some of the stress.
That's
out of it. Yeah.
And some of the angling, like, should I ask for the money she owes me or shouldn't I? It's like, no. If it's business, house business, you owe me the money, and then we'll worry about romance separately.
Yeah,
which I like. I mean, maybe it's old school, maybe it's not. I think it's less than old school.
We do that too. I mean, I like to keep track of, I don't like to owe anything to anybody.
Sure.
So I like to keep track of you. Okay, how much did you spend on groceries? Okay, I'll give you half of that, because it really is like a team.
Yeah,
you know?
And the other thing too for me is it does go to that idea that I need to know that Emily's not with me because she gets cheap rent or some, or pays no rent. Let's say I was like, I'll pay all the rent. Well, then I'm not sure why she's here. I never will fully trust, you know, I'm not saying if there was some shitty month or something where we had to help each other out.
Right.
But you know what I'm saying is that I would be like, wait a minute, are you here because of golden handcuffs? Because it's cheaper and easier to
wondering about that.
I would be wondering about that. I'm not that secure that I could pay for everything and then still think that she loves me for me. Right?
Money is tricky.
It is tricky. And I met her broke and I met her in debt and she didn't even know I was an actress for the first month. She thought I was just doing the photos. So I like that. Like, we have the right beginning. She didn't see me on a TV show and go, oh, that's that guy from that TV show.
Yeah.
I wish she did. I really did. Like, you know, I wish I could have fucking walked over to her and been
I'm the knight in shining armor.
I'd like to work with this one.
Then I found out he wasn't English and I was like, oh.
Was that a letdown?
Oh, okay. Well, no, you know, because I can ask. He'll do it anytime.
He'll do the... Yeah. He'll put on the jod purse and... is there anything else you want to talk about? This is a delight, by the way. You know, the one thing with these podcasts is I don't know you that well. You know, I know you and we get along and connect, but it's so nice to have you over for a chat.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to just sit down and talk without... I mean, it's also nice because this cat is just really into me. So it's like the three of us getting to know each other. Hi, Madeline. Yeah. But let's see if there's anything else I want to talk about. This is really neat. Yeah, but it's really nice to chat and have someone actually listen to you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think more people should do that. Just sit down and talk and listen.
Well, it's funny because in my parents' house, you know, and I go on and on about my parents being nuts and this and that. But the one thing they provided, while not maybe energetically, was a consistent environment in the sense that if you come over to my parents' house, you will sit in the living room for a chat with them. Like, you will, if you, Hannah, came over today. I really like that. You know, there's a sense of ceremony where you'll come and you'll go to the living room where there's no TV and you'll sit down and my dad will get you some tea or crackers or sherry and it's really old school and have a bit of a chat. But what's interesting is some of my friends now, when I'm not there, we'll go by to say hi to my folks. Because when they were 10, it was the first time an adult actually asked them something about themselves and kind of listened.
Made them feel legitimate and valued.
Yeah. And again, I mean, again, the listeners know this. I do complain about the folks a lot. And those complaints, I think, are legitimate. But it never negates what's awesome about them. And that's one of those things that I love. You know, we have a big-ass fucking TV. It's just not in our living room. And it's simply because I want to know who's coming to my house, you know? And I certainly don't begrudge anything. I mean, when I go to people's houses with TVs in their living room, I'm like, oh, this is the best. Like, it's so chill.
It's all about the company that you're with. I mean, one of my favorite, we don't have a TV in our living room either, and we didn't growing up. But one of my favorite things to do is just sit, you know, with tea or wine or whatever, just play games and talk with good friends, people who make you feel good.
Oh yeah, it's the best.
It is the best.
I wonder if there's something to an artist, and maybe not, but for me, I mean, a film artist, watching TV was active. So you would either have conversation, go play, go tobogganing, or watch TV. Watching TV was never a default growing up. And look, we're both directing films. Like, it's an active viewing process. It's not on in the background. And then all of a sudden, it's like we seem to know how things piece together and how to advance the making of. I don't know.
Did you have movie nights with your family growing up?
My parents love old movies. I mean, my mom probably has VHS and DVD recordings of about 1,000 movies.
1,000?
Oh, yeah. The whole den is littered with them.
That's an achievement.
It's literally an achievement. I mean, it's like she could be a rental studio if the quality wasn't so kind of... I know. And she'd, you know, when new versions would play, like if she's got Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and then she'd be like, oh, I'm setting the VCR because they're doing a newly colored version, and I the old one's getting a little worn out. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember VHS, but
oh, I know VHS.
Okay, so part gets worn out, you know, the the scene in Hot Dog where the girl takes her shirt off, worn out on my VHS copy. Damn. Of Hot Dog. Somebody kept playing
wonder
that.
Why
somebody kept watching that over and over.
Someone
I don't know
really
who it
liked
is.
That movie.
Hashtag Shannon Tweed. But my parents are, you know, I'm burning out Hot Dog and they're burning out Vertigo and Nosferatu and Metropolis, but they love those old movies. So every night almost they watch movies, so that it wasn't movie night, it was movies at night. Mm-hmm. Which was kind of cool. Or Love Boat and Remington Steele, but they love those old movies, still do.
My parents do too, and I would credit them quite a bit for fostering my love of movies and the arts. I mean, my dad's an actor as well.
He is in Winnipeg.
And he's got a great story because he was in a job when he was 18. He auditioned for the National Theatre School in Montreal, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to get in. Mm-hmm. He got in.
Wow.
But he didn't go.
What?
Because I think he felt pressure from his parents to go and, you know, have a real career.
Wait, would this
money.
Have been like late 60s kind of thing?
I believe so.
Like Paul Thompson, like I can't, anyways, I just
It was back in the day.
I heard great stories about National Theatre School. Like one unnamed head of the National Theatre School, whose name starts with a P and ends with an Al Thompson, took a bunch of acid on the opening day and like drummed in all the students, and what? It took like 8 hours while he'd like, I'm going to drum you in.
I really hope that someone captured that on video.
Oh, God.
And it's on VHS.
And by the way, this is totally apocryphal. Yeah, which part would be burnt out, though? I mean, which part's getting grainy?
Oh,
right?
Man, that's a good question.
I'm sure someone got fucking naked and danced to Aquarius type.
I hope so.
I mean, that was the era. But so the... by the way, I don't know if that ever happened, but I did one of the best pieces of work I've ever done. Not me personally, but with Paul. We created a play together.
You did?
Yeah, one called Death of the Hired Man with... who else was in it? I mean, David Fox helped develop
it. Oh, David Fox. He's lovely.
He's a genius. And then I can't... I'm going to forget a lot of this stuff, but Gil Garrett did it with us. That's when he first fell in love with Blythe. He's the artistic director there now. But it was just beautiful. And it was funny what you talk about with, you know... I do have this theater background, and I did the first play I've done in 14 years this spring, and it's so fulfilling and so awesome to just do something. Like, we went and lived on farms and learned about farming in the 50s while creating a show about farming in the 50s, going from, like, really communal thrash farming into combine farming. So we'd go stook sheaves on guys' farms and stuff. Like, this is how Paul works. So by the time we were doing the play, which was a really great play, I'd lived this thing. Mm-hmm. The way you hear about like De Niro driving cabs in New York, we'd been farmers.
It's in your body.
In it. There was no acting required. The only acting required was to make sure the back row could hear it. That's it. Everything else is taken care of already. Have you done much theater? Have you done that kind of work?
I did a little bit of theater outside of school, but other than that,
yeah.
No. We did some creation stuff in third year. In George Brown, and that was some of my favorite.
Right on.
It was.
But I mean, you went to theater school.
I went to theater school, so I did theater. Yeah, we did theater, and I mean, there is nothing like the live element of theater. It's almost an addiction.
It is an addiction.
It's incredible. It's an
so
incredible
your dad said no to NTS.
So he said no, and he spent 40 years in a career that he hated. He was working computer security for Hydro or something. I don't even really know what that means. But he didn't like it, and he was unhappy, and he retired about, I think, 5-6 years ago. And I said, why don't we take an acting class together?
No.
A film class together. And we did. We took a film class, and he was really good.
Wow.
He was really good. And I went to journalism and sort of, you know, stopped that, and he just kept going. And now he works all the time in Winnipeg.
Wow.
So he's, you know, when I said I'm quitting journalism to move to Toronto to become an actor, he was very...
That's fantastic.
He was very supportive, and so was my mom.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and so we can call each other and shoot the shit and go, oh, man, this sucks, and this is great, and it's... And he's so happy. I mean, he's found his passion in life.
I have love for Winnipeg, actually, for my joking about you mentioning it, because when I was down and out with my career, mm-hmm. the first real role I booked back was a lead in a film that shot in Winnipeg, a movie of the week. And I just fucking every morning knelt and was like crying with gratitude that I was getting a second chance at a career. Mm-hmm. I was probably 34, maybe 34, probably. So it's like, you know, I'm a grown man. Still not out of debt or anything, but just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's happening.
There's a chance. Like, I was actually so much more grateful than those first younger series leads. Those felt like, of course. This was like, oh, you're kidding me. I fucking jettisoned it all. So Winnipeg and me have real love. And I think there's a furniture place downtown. Nice. Is it called Hooper's or something?
Yes.
Gorgeous furniture. Yes. I didn't have the money, but I picked out about $5,000 worth of Danish teak that I wanted to send home to LA. I just couldn't do it. Right?
Danish teak, it can't go wrong.
And that's, I mean, it was minus 30 there. And I, again, maybe I was happy, but I was just, I didn't want to go underground. I was up and like, yeah. Oh,
I love hearing that. Mean, I talk to people who've been to Winnipeg, and it's usually they're there in the dead of winter. And I'm like, what are you doing there in the dead of winter?
I like winter too.
But there's a really incredible arts community there that a lot of people don't realize exists. So
even Sudbury, I mean, look, Sudbury's not my favorite town, but if I'm up shooting a film in Sudbury, I'm gonna have some fun in Sudbury. Like, I have love for Sudbury.
I don't think I've never been to Sudbury, but yeah, those small towns are where there's magic in those small towns.
There's magic. And I also love hotel rooms, man. Like, if I'm just like, if I can go to the gym and eat at the whatever place across the road.
You've got everything you need. Everything you need.
Give Emma a call, watch a shitty movie.
And it's the best.
And feel guilt-free about it all because I'm working.
Yeah. And you order that steak. You order that giant pasta and the three desserts. And what do you stew whatever you want. You come back the next day and your room is clean. It's amazing. Yeah.
And to the layperson, and by that I just mean a civilian, and by that I mean not an actor listening, it might be hard, and you probably have some version in your life where you don't know when or if you're ever going to do your favorite thing again, at least professionally, your favorite thing. And then you get to do it, and you're like, you're going to be here for 3 weeks in this hotel. And that's a bit of the relish that Hannah and I are talking about. Is you're like, what are you kidding? I get to work for a month. I get to do my favorite thing in the day and then come home. And for me, it's like not have to retouch photos tonight, not have to put together an acting class tonight. All things I love, but I definitely hustle to do them. For me, the easiest thing in my life, I don't care how intense the role is acting. Mm-hmm. It's getting the acting job. It's providing the living that creates the platform for the acting job. These are the hard things.
Oh, it's that feeling. It's the feeling of elation. It's like a working vacation. When you're paid to go to this small town or wherever this beautiful place is, you're there for however long. And then, you know, you go and you film during the day. You come back to the hotel at night. And you're with your cast or your crew or both, and you create this family together. Yeah. And then it becomes, I find, very difficult to say goodbye after that.
It is hard to say goodbye. And one of the things that obviously you and I have in common is we've proven that we do it anyways. Mm-hmm. Because there was no project called Comeback until you created it. There was no project called Barn Wedding until me and two other people created it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the whole like, yeah, I'd be doing it anyways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's not bullshit to be like, oh, this is my favorite thing. I love it. It's like, no, if no one hires me, I'll go do it still.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go make my own work.
And it's a perverse need in a way. You know that quote? That Martha Graham quote?
I don't know that quote.
Oh, my God. What were you just going to say? I'll find the quote.
Oh, God. What was I just going to say? I don't remember.
There's a blessed unrest or something. Enough people know this, but let's read it for everybody because this one really applies whether you're an artist or not. So this is a quote by Martha Graham, and I think she had sent it to, I won't find who she sent it to. Martha Graham, who if you don't know is like one of the pioneers of modern dance, if not the pioneer of modern dance. A quote by Martha Graham. There's a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action, and there is only one of you in all time. This expression is unique, and if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, not how it compares with other expression. It's your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others.
Well, where was that at the start of theater school?
They don't teach that shit. Well, maybe they did. Actually, Peter Wilde was pretty great about giving us those, like,
Wow, that's really a quote. I mean, that, the whole thing about keeping that channel open and the blessed unrest.
Oh yeah,
because that is what drives us. It's something in our coursing through our veins and our blood. It's like this need. And honestly, if I, you know, it's almost like therapy for me. If I couldn't act, if I didn't have the opportunity to act, you know, sometimes I catch myself just talking to myself, and everyone does it, but I'm like, suddenly I'm speaking in a different accent. And I'm like, what the heck? What the hell's going on? I need to do some acting. I need to get this out.
Yes, it has to come out. The only thing I disagree with that, and it's because I know, like, world champion martial artists, and I know people who do Ironmans and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm not sure it makes us more alive than the others. It's just our version of being alive.
Yeah, it's just whatever floats your boat. That's what floats ours.
And interestingly for me, we did get all this at George Brown in my generation, and that little bit that I disagree with was part of what I think kept me from connecting with the work, was that, and that's what makes us more alive than the others. It was sort of a Ponzi, we're better, or it's more noble to do theater, or it's, you know, we have the market cornered on a certain kind of living. And I felt distant from that idea. And as a result, I not only was trying to bridge a gap that was inauthentic for me, because I don't believe it, but I also then push the notion away and a lot of other good notions with it. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, it does. I mean, I think there is something slightly pretentious about, you know, is the way to act and this is the only way to act.
Yes.
And I think that's dangerous, because then you end up just trying to please the so-called experts. The one thing I will say about George Brown is, I mean, I did have an amazing time there.
Me too.
And created a family.
But it was amazing.
And it's a struggle. It's very difficult, much more difficult than I ever thought it was. But, you know, not only did I make incredible connections, but I have this work ethic ingrained in me. And now I know how to balance 1,000 projects at once.
Yes.
And I've got that work
yes.
in me somewhere.
Yes.
So even if I think I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, that's the one thing about George Brown, and I'm sure a lot of other places, but there specifically, it's not a university program. So you're on your feet the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have your monologue ready, and you have to have your scene study ready, and you have to have your mask work ready, and you have to have, and it's the most intense thing ever, and it's all on your feet.
Yeah.
And so it's just, there's no way to keep up. And that's for me what's interesting too about what you're talking about with even learning lines later in the process is, well, first off, you know, I believe that once, if you and I have this relationship, we can overlay any lines we want right now. Like if the camera was on us, I could say, fucking hate you, get out of my house, or I absolutely love you, I hope Emily doesn't comb for half an hour. Like it plays either way as long as we're already talking.
Uh-huh.
So the lines can overlay more easily later once we've established our job, which is the relationship, which is something that we, again, worked in the exact reverse order at theater school. So then what happens is I think I have to juggle all of this plotting and planning, but I don't. I just have to show up full in the right ballpark. And that's why guys like, I don't know what the girl equivalents are, but like Marlon Brando or Jimmy Dean could pull off such brilliant work while being absurd in their approach, because they're like, fuck all that, I'm here. Yeah. What else do you want? I'm right here.
Our mask teacher, Renya, was all about that. She would say, you know, I am here, because that's what it is. You're did you have Renya too?
Yeah.
She's fiery. She's a firecracker.
And a genuine, you know, she was a great teacher. She's one of the ones I remember very well there.
But it takes a certain type of focus, and that is why we were talking about, I try not to bring my phone with me to set, because then I've got 1,000 things floating around in my mind and I can't focus on where I am in the present moment and just be reacting.
Yeah. One more question before we wind her down, unless you got to rush out. Do you got to go?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. One more question. And this is something that comes up a lot lately. Do you consider yourself a woman artist, just an artist? It seems like the times are about more funding for women projects, and even, you know, the distributor I'm talking to for Barn Wedding for our next project is like, well, it's not female driven. Like they're just looking for something very specific, and that's how it goes. Are you aware of that? Are you happy about that, or do you even consider it at all? Do you take it for granted?
I'm happy about it. I mean, I think there's a lot of powerful women out there who are young. I mean, young women coming up in the world who are creating some incredible things.
Your generation's insane. It's
and
brilliant.
Leading
this city's
the way,
like run
yeah.
by talented women right
And I'm
now
very inspired. I'm inspired by that because I see, you know, oh, this person, this incredible woman is making this project. She's putting herself out there. So I think I can do that too.
Yeah.
So I find it very inspiring. I think I have trouble with the word feminism, because
right.
I think it's just the definition of it has been lost somewhere,
right?
And there's been all this negativity around it, but I'm all for it. I love it.
I mean, I am too. I was actually very much raised a feminist by my mom, who was one of those early fighters at the university to get like equal pay for women, to get maternity leaves,
man.
Like stuff that we take for granted now. Like
yeah.
she had to be called a bitch and a shrew and all that stuff just to like at a council meeting say, why would I accept 30% less for the exact same job, you know?
Yeah,
and then,
that's crazy.
And what's hard, and this is, I think, where the feminist word gets lost, and I'll just use my mom as an example. If she's also got a temper in other things, it's real easy to go, oh, that's just you and your temper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, right, yeah, I do have a temper, but that's irrelevant
to this.
Yeah, that
has nothing to do with this.
No,
nothing.
And I think it's a real way to put a thumb on people, whether it's fucking black guys looting too much and you're like, see, they're looting. And it's like, yeah, that is bad there, but that's not what we're talking about.
No.
We're talking about a general current underneath that needs to be looked at. So that becomes the one that makes it easy to dismiss. So I'm with you because I think the word feminist has gotten this weird taint, but only because... yes, some people got real loud about ideas or splinter versions, but generally speaking, again, it's that response to that lame Subway post about like, how's feminist work? And did you see that on the Subway?
I didn't see that.
Oh my God, you didn't see
this?
Show
me.
Okay, so how's feminism working? This guy posted this on the Subway, somebody. Okay, this anti-feminist ad came up.
Uh-oh.
And it basically said, hey, ladies, you're not getting any dates, can't afford the high condo fees on your own, you're 30 and still not married, how's feminism working for you? You want some answers? Go to blah, blah, blah. And it's one of these pro-men groups.
Is that like, a joke?
No, it's not a joke.
That's...
it's not a joke. So some guy actually, again, it's these... well, you can have a black awards for film. Well, why can't you have a white awards for film? It's like,
oh,
are you that fucking dumb that you don't know why you can't?
It's about, you know, it really is. It's just about we're trying to have equality in the world. And that's the word that's getting lost. It's equality because that bullshit's still happening. You got to wade through a lot of bullshit.
Well, and I talk about this on the podcast is that I'm for affirmative action when done right, because what you just said, you see other young women getting the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's through a funding directive.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, okay, we notice that there's too few women directing film. So what we're going to do is start a fund that only gives money to women directors. That's called affirmative action. You call it whatever you want, but that's what that is. All of a sudden, young girls go, wait, that girl's a director? I want to be a director too.
I can do that. Yeah.
My brother's daughter, my niece, saw my Porsche and goes, what's that? And I'm like, a Porsche? And she's like, I want a Porsche too. We go,
good
God
for
bless her,
her
right? My fucking powers are working. But so in any case, that for me is one of those things where if there's no example of it, it's never going to take hold. It'll never proliferate. But where is this response? It was so good. I posted it on my Facebook page. It's basically like, how's feminism working for me? How about equal pay for equal work? How about time off for maternity leave? How about the fact that I can now work at the city? You know, blah, blah. All the good things
here.
That are so inherent. And again, I mean, I'm not right wing or left wing, but... yes, I am, because fucking when people are like, oh, feminism's destroying whatever, they're too loud. It's like, you never hear that on the left.
Yeah,
like,
do you know what you're saying?
Do you know what you're saying?
If like half the population just took a second to hear what's coming out of their mouth, they'd probably just shut the fuck up.
Well, they would, and that's why I'm always shocked how many women claim they're going to vote for Donald Trump.
Don't even.
Don't eat, but hey, the I always talk about this. These people are voting next to you. People who literally are going to be worse off. Nobody votes in their own self-interest if they're dumb as fuck. I'm not saying who's dumb as fuck.
I don't think people know how to vote.
I don't think they know how to vote. And it's tough. I mean, I did an online survey to see if I was a liberal, an NDP, or a conservative, or a Green Partier.
Do that. How'd that go?
It's a complicated survey, and I'm a pretty bright guy. Like, it was like, do you think, and it wasn't, it was a great survey because it wasn't just, are you for or against Iraq or whatever? It was literally stuff that was the fundament of the bills that these people will be creating and voting on. And I was like, I get why most people don't do this. I have a lot of time on my hands. I mean, I actually don't, but you know what I mean? I have those 10 minutes to get on these quizzes, mm-hmm. and I care about it. But no, well, that's just it. That's the thing. We should
care.
It's complex, but it's no more complex than, I don't know what else, setting up your PVR.
Yeah, or like putting a car together, working on your car, your motorcycle. I don't have any of these things.
But see, this is the thing, is that people don't do this anymore. People aren't setting up their own PVR. The guy comes and does it and shows you what three buttons you got to press. Or people are, generally speaking, I mean, our Macs are so user-friendly that...
Yeah, we need other people to tell us how to think.
A little bit. And not even how to think, but how to... I mean, not just how to think, how to open and use my camera. Like... Now, I pride myself on this. I read the manuals cover to cover, but I know that most people...
Wow. I wouldn't.
Right. And so that's a bit of that politics thing, is you're kind of required at least once every 4 years if you want to vote in your own self-interest legitimately. But most people's self-interest is, I like that guy. He reminds me of me. And it's like, you're talking about the billionaire?
Oh, it's a popularity contest.
You're talking about the billionaire who's never won... Like, how does he remind you of you?
No, it doesn't make
factory
any sense.
Factory worker, and God bless factory workers, but how are you thinking that you and any of these, let's say super hyper rich people, like hyper rich, like hundreds of millions and more, have anything in common, especially in a country where your healthcare is not free?
I don't understand it. I mean, we could go on and on about this. The hard thing is that politics... This is the wrong thing to say, but politics are really fucking boring.
Yes, it is.
They're so boring.
Yes,
and,
it is.
But we
Try
have
watching,
to care.
Like CPAC or whatever that is. Like,
I want to tune into the debates, and I need to, you know, go back and watch them. But I'm like Snorefest. I, you know, and it's also there is a lot of bullshit. It's hard to wade through and go. What are you actually saying? What do you actually stand for?
Well, most don't say what they stand for. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's why everybody loves Bernie Sanders right now. Whether they love him or hate him, he's speaking clearly. He's an actual person who's saying what he thinks. So again, I'm not trying to persuade anybody, but what I am saying is that's what people love about Trump. He's not, at least he's saying what he wants to say. And Bernie Sanders is the Democratic version of someone who's not beholden to anybody. So he's like, this is blah, blah, blah. This is blah, blah, blah. Maybe people don't agree with what he's saying, but no one can argue that he's not authentic about it. Whereas, I mean, when I look at the Canadian stuff, I'm like, talking point, talking point, talking point, talking point. So I can't watch an hour and a half of talking points.
It's just a lot of blah, 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 political speak. Why don't you speak like a human so we can understand you?
Well,
anyway.
Speaking of blah, 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 political speak, I'm boring the fuck out of my listeners. Listeners,
that's what politics do.
People, we changed our minds. Don't do the quiz. Go to Hannah Anderson's Instagram. Go to her Facebook. Blow her up. You're going to see her all over the TV if you haven't already. Hannah, you're a delight.
Thanks, Sean.
To see the work you're going to do.
I'm pretty excited. Also, Indiegogo, I'll just quickly mention.
Oh my God, this is half the reason I was so excited to have you on here. Go.
So, we have launched an Indiegogo campaign to help finish post-production on our film. I think we've got 17 days left. I'm asking for 15 grand, which seems like a lot, but it's, you know, it's for a really, really amazing cause. So, we've got, I think we were almost at 3 grand, so we need a little help.
Yes.
So, spread the word, get the word out there. Come back the short film on Indiegogo.
Definitely go do this. And by the way, you're underselling this because you're willing to do dares. Is that still happening?
It's still happening.
Okay, so I've actually donated an undisclosed amount to get... Well, we're not going to say what yet, but just know...
I'm working on it, Sean.
You have to work on it because it's epic.
It. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard the song yet?
Yep.
Okay, there's some work to be done, right?
There's some work.
Okay, yeah. So these dares are phenomenal and delightful. So get on Comeback, the Indiegogo campaign, and follow this stuff. You know, there are times where I think Indiegogo can be misused, and this is the exact opposite of one of them. I think this is a valuable project, and I think it's going to be a stunning project.
Thanks.
And I think it really warrants people contributing and seeing it ultimately in its best form. I mean, I'm working right now on getting finishing money for Barn Wedding, and it's hell, you know. And we're not at the place where we want to do the Indiegogo, but in ways I wish I had back earlier.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm proud of you and happy that you're doing it this
Thank
way.
Thank you. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
It is worth it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Hannah Anderson.
You're welcome, John Benson.
This is Chatting Between Takes, and that's a wrap.